This is Mark Dernberger on the road to Dannebrog, Nebraska, the home of CBS Sunday Morning's Roger Welch, and until recently, also the home of John McKinney. For a number of years, the engineer in charge of the FCC's Grand Island, Nebraska monitoring station. We visited John last September. At the time, he was a picture of health at 83, and we were shocked to learn of his death just a few weeks after our conversation.
This might be a good time to start talking about the monitoring station.
Okay.
It was built about 1929, I think, wasn't it?
Monitoring station was built in 1929. Along in the late 20s, we had field offices around, you know, Detroit, Chicago, New York, and so forth. St. Paul. They were very concerned about broadcast stations. How do you... You need a special set of apparatus in order to make measurements on broadcast stations in order to see if they stay on frequency and meet certain requirements and then conduct themselves the way they
and
are
when we say broadcast, we're talking medium wave AM at
wave
that time.
Broadcast.
There was no FM.
No, we're talking that which is between 550 and 1500 kilocycles at that time.
I love the fact that you said kilocycles, too.
Yeah, no, it's kilocycles. Should have stayed that way. Anyway, the Federal Radio Commission decided they needed a monitoring station, and they decided that if all things being equal, if they could get good reception and so forth, they should be somewhere near the middle of the United States, because they were talking about a monitoring station. And they figured with good beverage antennas and so forth that they could at some time, you know, be able to monitor the bulk of the United States stations from that point. They wanted to find out if they could. They had some inspection cars, Black Mariahs, they were called later. They were Studebakers that were built with a wood body. They were like a hearse almost. And they had equipment in the back. And even the cab was of wood. And they used loop antennas on them. And a big battery supply on the thing, because everything was battery operated in those days. I mean, everything was completely battery operated. They had receivers in the back, and they were manned by two men. One of them made passes all through the Midwest here, and they checked ground conductivity. They did all sorts of things and listened to signals and what have you. And they decided that Grand Island, Nebraska was the place to put the monitoring station. So it was the monitoring station. So work went ahead, and by 1929, they had purchased or were given, I think they were given, a piece of land in a particular location. I want to say it's either 40 or 60 acres to begin with. But it expanded after that. Of course, in the World War II and all, we got more acreage, got more antennas and so forth. But that's when it started, 1929. The first notice of violation was sent out in 1931, by the time they got the station manned and so forth. And the station was absolutely complete in itself. They generated their own power, and most of the equipment, like I say, even the equipment, like I say, the mobile equipment was all battery. Well, so was we had huge banks of batteries in the monitoring station, 120-volt banks of batteries. So the lighting and everything in the station was off of these 120-volt big banks of batteries. And there was a big battery room in the back annex to the station. They had a diesel engineer on the payroll. They charged the batteries in the daytime. They did a minimum of night work at the time. I mean, mostly it was a daytime type of occupation. But at certain nights, men would be out there maybe at midnight or after midnight and do some monitoring and all to check on what's going on at that time of day. When I first went out there in 1941, that battery room was still there with all the batteries in it, but they was not being used. Everything had gone. AC power had been brought into the location not long after the station was built. So they went on over to AC power. I'd say maybe they operated a year on batteries or somewhat, and then they went over. And then battery or AC-operated receiving sets were coming in about 1928, 29, you know, in through there. So we got away from the battery concept. And when they brought the power in, the power came in. The closest power takeoff was a half a mile from the station, and it came underground there into the station. And so the only wire that came into the station when the station was built was a telephone line. When the war started, before the war started, the reason I was hired out there, in 1939, when the war began in Europe, we became concerned about radio traffic and so forth, and spies and this sort of thing. So they started to hire extra people at the monitoring stations. They established what was called the NDO, the National Defense Operation. But as soon as war was declared, they changed it over to the Radio Intelligence Division, RID. We were the same people. But by then, we hired quite a few of us hams and what have you. By this time, they started to build monitoring stations other places. Well, they ended up with around 13 primary monitoring stations.
Across the country.
Across the country, including one in Honolulu, near Honolulu, and one in Alaska, near Anchorage. We had a station in Puerto Rico, and we had these primary stations, and now Grand Island being a primary station, we had a lot of secondary stations coming out. We had one in Sturgis, South Dakota, another one in Omaha. And these were just a rented room with a man with a receiver and so forth.
And a loop antenna?
Right, loop antenna or what have you.
Okay.
But they didn't have the communication facilities that we had or the equipment to work with. But they were on these spots, so we could get a hold of them if we had something in that area. They were close by to go out and investigate it. A lot of them had a car with a loop antenna on it, too.
Right.
I took a little time off of monitoring and went out and helped put some loops in the top of some Studebakers there when I was at Grand Island. Yeah.
So if a casual... like me who was interested in DXing, if I had driven by that plant, what would I have seen at that station? What was in the backyard?
In the backyard? Well, we had we would have had two direction finders out there, Adcock-type direction finders, well away from the building, well away from everything, and nothing more near them for a while.
Can you explain for the non-technical people what an Adcock is?
Adcock is a... The old Hadcock, the first Hadcock they used during World War II, was a small house on stilts that you reached the inside of the house by going up a ladder underneath the center of the house and through a trap door, which after you got in there, you closed, became part of the floor. And in there you had a bench about the size of a desk that you sat before on a stool. And coming down into that direct center of that desk space, there was a wheel that rotated a pipe that went on up through the peak of the roof of this little shack that you have. Not too far above the roof, there was a boom extending, maybe 12 or 15 feet.
Horizontal.
Horizontal boom, extended 12 to 15 feet either side, with the dipoles, vertical dipoles on the ends of this boom. So they had twin feed lines from those dipoles come in and were phased out and dropped down through the pipe and into a Hammerland SX-28 receiver that we used there, which was battery operated. We had no power out there because to put any lines, any wires out there whatsoever, we felt would distort our bearings. Later we found out we could bury them deep enough and we could get by with all this. But that was the original Adcock.
But it was a direction finder.
It was a direction finder. That's what it was. Adcock direction finder, right. They're medium frequencies.
So you had two Adcocks.
We had two Adcocks, right.
What else did you have back there?
Well, across the road we had 80 acres of rhombic antennas. Now, I'll tell you about the rhombics. It was a semicircle of rhombic antennas spaced 20 degrees apart. So we had one 10 degrees, 30 degrees, 70 degrees, 90 degrees, and so forth through a semicircle, which were double-ended. You could terminate them either way. So it'd give you a full circle of rhombic antennas 20 degrees apart. All right, now, for the beverage antennas, where they were there since almost the beginning of time, when it was put in, there were five beverage antennas that were put in. These were put in, they're some of the earliest ones that were put in, because they were interested in broadcast, and they wanted the low-frequency wave antenna for that purpose, and of course they wanted as much gain as they could get. The longest one we had was 1,800 feet long, and you wouldn't even recognize it, because it ran down over the barbed wire fence. The road to the monitoring station runs north and south. So this was the north-south beverage. And it ran, and the station sat in the middle of the mile, half a mile from either other road. The only thing you could notice on this was that everybody wondered, why did they put all the insulators every few feet in that barbed wire fence down below? And the beverage was those fence posts were higher than normal fence posts. They were about 12 foot high. But they actually had the fence at the bottom. They had that on the top.
So there was a beverage of about 1,800 feet.
1,800 feet. That was good.
North, south.
Dual terminated, so it was either north or south. There was another beverage going out through the backfield that we called the Atlanta one. It was kind of focused on Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't remember the exact, in other words, it was southeast. And there was another one that was due east, 90 degrees. It was great, you know, if you wanted to get Washington, D.C. or Denver. Or San Francisco, right? East and west. And there was another that was pointed at Chicago, somewhere around 70 degrees. There was another one that was, probably pointed more at Minneapolis, I would say. I can't remember, in that general area.
Northeast, yeah. Slightly.
Yeah. Okay. Which the backside of that would have given you Arizona or New Mexico, you see what I mean?
The graveyard stations, at the time, were all 250 watts day and night. And there were hundreds of them on the air at that time, I think, mm-hmm. weren't there? Those five local channels?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you able to copy those off the beverage?
Copy some of them.
Did you have to phase two beverages copy them?
No. You'd be surprised what you could copy. The main thing was how much interference you're getting from someone else in the same general direction. This is where the problem. Yeah, I want to give you an example, something that I did one time. I was monitoring, and I was looking over the broadcast band to find out if I could find anybody off frequency, and I got a warble on KOA's frequency, KOA Denver. Where is it, 800 and something?
850.
Yeah. I was just on a general antenna, I think. I hear this, boom, 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 boom. Hey, somebody's off frequency. Either he is or someone else. Something is beating against something else. So I switch over to the beverage, double-ended beverage. I've got KOA just pouring in. I switch the thing to the other side. He drops down to a level that I can read and identify, but not too clear. A little station over in Iowa, or maybe it was the other side of Iowa or something, sharing that frequency. It was daytime. You know. And I measured him, and he was out of tolerance. We only allowed 20 cycles, 20 hertz. And I don't know, he was 25 or 30, so he's going to get a citation for that. But I was able to identify the station and all. This shows you the front-to-back ratio that you could get with something. I mean, you got 50 kilowatts pouring at you from there, and about the same distance or so away, we got this little, maybe it was a 1 kW station or something. Most of my work with the commission, we were not really interested too much in what the broadcasters were doing. We did it incidentally. I mean, we were more interested in what Russia was doing or what Germany was doing, depending on what time period we're talking at, you know what I mean? So we were spending more time with shortwave than we were on the others. But we covered the broadcast band. And
the beverages were probably your workhorses, weren't they?
The beverages for a medium wave band were our workhorses, right, yeah. Oh, we had a few wire antennas, 60 feet high, simple wire antennas, yes.
For the easy stuff.
Yeah.
Did you have any big loops, big direction-finding loops?
No, there were loops right in the main building themselves when the station was put up. There are old pictures of Colster radios or RCA cabinet radios if you were a millionaire at that time, it might be in your living room, in a mahogany cabinet,
right.
You know. They had a couple of nice big ones there and with a loop on top of them. Now, mm-hmm. how much work they did with those, I don't know. That was before my time. I'm talking, that was early 30s sometime,
sure.
late 20s, yeah.
We're now going to talk about how the station operated on a daily basis and what the station watched for to give citations, the dreaded citations. John, I guess you could copy just about every station on the band from Grand Island.
Oh, yeah. Pretty well, yeah.
And you looked at frequency tolerance. Were you measuring over modulation?
Oh, yes. We measure over modulation. If the signal is strong enough to measure over modulation. Okay. Hey, I'm looking in my drawer. I got a ticket. I got a light. I kept it for a souvenir. I've got off frequency violation there from the Grand Island monitoring station when I was working for him. I'll tell you this quick. A ham club in Grand Island. We used to have a picnic, and we invite people in from all over. They come in from Lincoln, Omaha, and what have you. And we'd meet in the park in the summertime. We had a big picnic there. And I took my transmitter out and let them use my call out there. Well, I was using a VFO at the time, instead of crystal control. And we always worked at the top end of the band. At that time, we used to work at 3995 was the Nebraska network frequency, mm-hmm. 5KC from the band. And while I'm messing around out there and somebody else is using the transmitter, they got the VFO and they got the thing out about 4001.5. And they were working. I mean, they were going to find. One of our club members, he had to work that day. You see, I mean, somebody has to work out the morning station. And he was listening in to see what was going on at the picnic. And he measured me out and he sent me a citation. SOB, I tell you.
He was working for you at the time, wasn't he?
And anyway, I've got it there, and I had to answer it.
I love it. You mentioned there were the primary and the secondary monitoring stations. How many stations were there at the peak of the service?
There were 52 approximately, maybe 13 primaries and the rest were secondaries.
Staffing-wise, Mac, when the station was at its peak, you had a room full of people, all had different jobs.
We didn't have very many people at a monitoring station. I mean, when there was not wartime, we had about 13 people.
Total staff.
Total staff. Right.
So during a 9-to-5 workday, half of them at work?
Well, we had two secretaries.
They were typing up the violation notices.
Yeah, they did that. We had a janitor, and the rest were all engineering. We had a maintenance man who could also stand watch when needed.
Let's talk about stand watch for a minute, because stand watch, this is obviously shipboard parlance.
It is. But
it's got parallels here. I can see in my mind's eye.
We were open 24 hours a day.
And I see in my mind's eye people scanning the dials, going up and down and listening to stations.
That's exactly right. And our watches went from 8 to 4, 4 to midnight, and midnight to 8.
And you just went up and down the spectrum.
And our staff rotated those watches. I mean, nobody, you were on midnights, the next week you were on days, and the next mm-hmm. week you were on evenings, you might say. So you moved.
Let's say I came into work a day shift.
Yeah.
I might be assigned to scanning the medium
band. That's right.
Yeah. Then next day I might be looking at 40 meters.
No, you'd have the whole spectrum. You might have instructions to concentrate on something, a certain portion or something, or we'd have stuff out of Washington sometimes. Let's look into more ship stuff here. Let's do less of this and mm-hmm. so forth. My men issued more citations on ocean-going vessels out of Grand Island than any other monitoring station, those on either coast or in Hawaii or anything else. We had a couple of men there that just really liked to pick on the ships. That always surprised them in Washington. Why is it that Grand Island out there, clear in the middle of the country, they'd give us a summary, you know, about every 3 months or so. He'd get a quarterly summary and who was doing what and so forth. The kind of thing, you better start looking a little more on broadcast, fella, because they're getting so many over here. Don't you monitor the broadcast band, you know?
Did you do things? Let's stay at the broadcast band for a minute. You knew, let's say maybe you got an edict from Washington. We're kind of scanning what the directional guys are doing. Would you get instructions such as monitor all the stations that you can reach that are directional to see that they change power at the proper time and actually clock when their patterns changed? Did you get that detail?
We might get orders on to look at a couple of them that they suspected were not being there. Yeah.
So you might be looking at 1330
and
on the clock watching to see time they change pattern.
Yeah, you might. You
and
might,
if
yeah,
they didn't change might. At 8:30 when they were supposed to?
If they had reports or complaints, you know, a lot of times, where's the complaint come from? A co-channel station saying, we're having trouble. Our listeners are saying that so-and-so is overlapping us in the early evening or something of that sort. And that would go through Washington. We just get, check this out for a few weeks, mm-hmm. you know, see if they change it in time and so forth. Yeah.
So in my hypothetical example on 1330, you're monitoring, you know, because you have a copy of their license or you know by the data that you have that they're supposed to switch at 8:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. in a given month.
Right.
And you don't hear the change.
That's right.
You're measuring the signal strength is exactly the same. You don't hear any carrier break.
That's right,
you know.
Right. We'd cite them.
They haven't done it. What do you do?
We'd probably cite them.
And what was that?
Unless the instruction said, do not cite, let us know. I mean, this might be a deal.
So your secretaries would
talk about... You know, that station could be owned by a senator or a congressman.
So if it didn't... That's the American way.
Normally we just cite them.
Someone in your office types an NAL, a Notice of Apparent Liability, and that arrives in the mail from the FCC and scares the bejunior out of people.
That's right.
There was a time when people were in awe of the policing power of the Federal Communications Commission.
They come back, and I'd have to check it. They'd send me a letter back telling me why it happened, or a good excuse, or what have you, and promising it will not happen again type of thing, right?
The other thing you did, I believe, here was gather data for sunspot effects on medium wave propagation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that program was going on long before I was in the commission. I mean, we had two recorder houses out apart from the station with antennas out there. The broadcast recording house, you talk medium frequency, had a vertical antenna, I don't know, probably 60 foot high. It was a copper pipe strapped, you might say, to a telephone pole. And we had several recorders we had receivers inside in racks and Estrel and Angus recorders in there to give signal strength and so forth of the signal. We could watch it. And of course, they're on a clock and so forth. So you could see the relative signal strength during the day. And that's, of course, this is, then you do it throughout the year. This is not a calibrated, it's a relative signal strength more than a calibrated signal strength.
Were these done throughout sunspot cycles?
Yes. And they went on for years. This went on for years, this thing. It'd give you the figures on the graph. Then we'd take these in, take the reels in, we'd have to analyze those and plot them all out with a divider and so forth and get the averages and so forth at certain times and make tabular information on that, which is all sent into Washington. Now, the VHF recording house, primarily Grand Island more than anyone else, but some of the others had some hand in it. We had a VHF recording house with receivers on the FM and TV band. In the early days when those were first coming out, we were looking at quite distant stations that we could receive with the Yagi-type antennas.
Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a lot of traffic on the band.
Wasn't a lot of traffic. And we kind of determined the spacing and so forth that would be needed and the frequencies and what have you that would be best for this. What's going to happen to the propagation? And we were doing this. We were figuring out how close together can you co-locate and adjacent locate.
Based on 50-50 and all the rest.
And then you're looking at what happens in the summertime and what happens in the wintertime, throughout the year.
So you got feels for ducting and inversions and all of that.
And then we, of course, were all found out that some of these things come skipping in there.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes this hobby so interesting.
Yeah.
You not only have the medium wave DXers, but there's an FM TV club that lives for inversions and e-skip and things. They love it. Logging things across the country.
I got a story that they'll enjoy. In the early days of TV here in Grand Island, there was no TV station. The closest station was one of two Omaha stations were on the air before anything was out here 150 miles west of there. I had a friend, he didn't work for, he was a grocer. We played cards together, he and his wife and my wife. He had a little neighborhood grocery store. His mother died in Omaha, and he inherited her television receiver. Now, this is black and white receivers, one of the early day receivers. Well, he got this thing, and he says to me, he says, "Do you think we can get a picture?" I says, "Well, Ernie, I think some people are getting some. Let's see." He had a small house. We got up on that roof, and we put up a pipe mast on there, a jointed mast. And I put stacked Yagis up there on channels, was it 3 and 6? The two Omaha channels. We pointed them towards Omaha. We came down, and we hooked it up on a Saturday afternoon, and this is in the summertime, to this receiver. And we start tuning across the band, and we get Buffalo, New York, Detroit, Michigan. You get Omaha, and everything else. Now, Ernie, being a merchant in town, they used to go to a Monday morning breakfast downtown, and the guys all get together. And this is on a Saturday that we saw these things. And he goes down on Monday, he says, "If you guys want to see some TV, buy a set and get John McKinney to put the antenna up, and you're going to get Detroit." I said, "Ernie, I told you that's a freak. Nobody says I watched it clear into the evening." It would fade out. He didn't care. In those days, if you saw a picture at all,
oh God,
I got a reputation in town that I could put up an antenna.
Well, you know what that's like. That's like in the medieval days, the sorcerer could call it. He knew the eclipse of the sun was coming, right? Do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could go all day, but we probably should quit. No. Did you do much work with FAA in terms of problems with people with tower lights or any of that?
No.
You didn't have to use. You just.
Well, we had tower light. Our inspections and so forth required tower lights.
Right.
But we did not go out and inspect broadcast stations from a monitoring station. I mean, that was done by, in this case, either the Denver office or the Minneapolis office or Kansas City office. I'm talking in this particular
right.
area.
And they were known as the Enforcement Bureau?
Yeah.
Well, you were in the Enforcement Bureau.
We're Enforcement,
Bureau.
Too.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
We're monitoring, and they're just field office.
And you were in the reporting business, really, to report the violations, and then somebody else would go out and pound on the door if necessary.
That's right.
Okay. Now, we've gone away from a lot of the offices are closed.
Yeah.
The monitoring stations are closed, and everything is automated.
It's all automated.
Automated. So what do you do when you've got a problem nowadays?
I don't know. I don't know where to go.
Our listeners are very frustrated by the fact that they're trying to log a station.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, there's no IDs anymore. People blow by the top of the hour. Number two, they're trying to monitor 660, and they know that the local guy is supposed to go off the air, and he doesn't.
Yeah.
Or they'll leave a dead carrier on all night and call that shutting down when, of course, it's not.
It's not, yeah.
What can you do anymore? Is there anybody you can go to for enforcement?
I don't know. Well, they have a complaint line, but I don't know whether it does any good to call there. You know, there's a number to call. Yeah.
So if you call that number, somebody will log it in, and maybe if 15 different people have complained about the same station, they might send a note to one of the few offices still open?
I suppose they would, yeah.
You discourage me when you say there just isn't the enforcement climate anymore.
No, there isn't, no. Well, look it. They took the enforcement out when they let the Sears Roebuck man fix the transmitter. There's no examination to see if you're qualified to work on a transmitter anymore. And really, how do you fix a transmitter today? Well, take this unit out and put this unit in. I mean, that's...
Which arrived in a blister pack.
Yeah.
Overnight mail.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the concept of public safety, all of that is archaic, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah. It's a different world. Well, I lived when it was good. I lived through the good part of it.
Boy, you have had quite a life.
Oh, I had a lot of fun.
John McKinney, Loving Life, as he sounded in September 2001, just a few weeks before his untimely death. John was engineer in charge of the FCC's Grand Island, Nebraska monitoring station, a station that went on the air in 1929 and, along with the rest of the FCC's monitoring system, went silent in the mid-1990s.